Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
So on behalf of NACSW, I'm delighted to welcome you to today's audio conference workshop entitled The DSM-5, Beyond Skepticism and Into Practicality, presented by Dr. David Cecil. The DSM-5, the American Psychiatric Association, key document for clinicians in our field, represents dramatic shifts in how we categorize mental disorders. There are numerous considerations, including international compatibility, practical implications, and controversies. In order to continue to competently and ethically integrate faith and social work, Christians in social work must stay current on these revisions. This workshop and this webinar will provide a brief overview of the history and focus of the DSM, as well as provide a summary of the most important changes in the DSM-5. Just before we begin our session, let me quickly cover a few important housekeeping items. For most of today's session, we'll be using a muting function, it's on now, to eliminate background noise that might compete with David's presentation. However, at a number of different intervals, we'll invite participants to raise questions and comments. During these intervals, if you have a question or comment, feel free to speak up. It might be necessary to enter *6 on your phone keypad. And then again, when we're done with Q&A, we'll return back to the muted function so that we're able to hear David as clearly as possible. A reminder that today's call will be recorded for folks who are interested in the material but can't participate. And then lastly, if you'd like to be able to see the presenter's online PowerPoint presentation, just send us an email to info@nacsw.org, and we've sent you the link to be able to actually see the PowerPoint online, or we'll be glad to send you a copy of the PowerPoint for your records as well. Again, just send an email to info@nacsw.org. So enough for the housekeeping. Without any further ado, I'm delighted to present our speaker, Dr. David Cecil. David, all yours.
All right, Rick, thank you. And it is always an honor to... Rick, there is some kind of beeping, I think, that I'm getting in the background.
I think I was able to just beep that out, so I think we're okay.
It sounded like somebody was backing up. I'm delighted to be here today, and anytime my good friend and colleague Rick calls upon me to do something with or for NACSW, I'm always try to do that, and so I've been looking forward to this webinar for several months now. I am today transmitting this from Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama. I just joined the faculty down here. For 7 years before this, I was at Asbury University and in a great social work program there, and now down here with the good social work faculty for the MSW program at Samford. I have been teaching psychopathology at least two, if not three times per year for the past, I think this is my 13th year as a full-time educator, and then worked for a number of years during grad school, during my master's program, and then beyond in community mental health. And then I've the last six or seven years, I've had a private practice on the side where I'd see maybe between 7 and 12 clients per week, and so I've been really fortunate to be able to stay current with the diagnostic practices, with the changes, with the DSM. Say again. With the DSM, to be completely honest about this, I had been teaching out of the DSM-4. For probably a decade or so when the DSM-5 revisions were coming out. And I knew they were going to be dramatic changes. I knew that APA was looking at making some really dramatic shifts. And so I basically, just to kind of create some urgency for myself to get my my lecture notes updated and not just updated, but really completely changed. I immediately signed up everywhere I could professionally to present about the DSM-5, including doing 3 and 6 hour CEU trainings in Kentucky. My first presentation was the day after the DSM-5 actually came out in bookstores in 2013. You could get most of the changes that were coming from their website, and I was able to build the presentation out of that, and then when the book came out, I could go back and sort of fact check it. There were a few things that were surprising when the actual publication came out, but so I have been teaching on the DSM-5 several times a year for the last few years, and then presenting on it in numerous places, including I've been going over every year for the last few years and teaching in Lithuania. And it's interesting the way that the DSM-5 and I can kind of move my slides along here. The way the DSM-5, a lot of the changes that we'll see today that are coming, that came out with the DSM-5, were about getting it a little bit more compatible with the ICD, which is, International Classification of Diseases, that most of the rest of the, industrialized world is using instead of the DSM. Probably most of you know this already, but the DSM-5 is really mostly only used in the United States. I think Brazil uses it, and there are a few other locations, but mostly this is what we do. But the good news is that somebody like myself can go over and educate potential future practitioners in Lithuania and feel fairly confident that the material is going to be very consistent between what is reflected in the DSM-5 and then in the ICD. So we got about a little more than an hour today, and it's always challenging to know. Like I said, I'll sometimes do 6 hour trainings on this, and then I teach a full semester courses around this material. And so what I try to do with a presentation like this is really kind of hit the high notes on some of the what I feel like are some of the more dramatic shifts in the DSM-5 compared to the DSM-4. I also kind of make an assumption here that for a lot of people who are interested in this topic, one or two things are probably true. One is maybe you were steeped and trained in the DSM-4, or maybe some of us go back even before the DSM-4. When we first got our training around diagnosing and around mental disorders, but then also probably people on a presentation interested in a presentation like this would be just are people who really want to stay current on the information, and you recognize that the repetition is very helpful. It's one of the best parts about teaching and training on this topic is that the details, they're not obviously not infinite, but they're enough that it can be difficult to kind of keep up with everything. And it's one of the great things about teaching. I would recommend to anybody watching this that if you're interested enough, and if you're like me and you find that it can be difficult to go back and keep learning about the material and keep using it, and repetition is helpful, look for a way to do some trainings where you are. Look for a way to kind of put yourself in the position where you have to really integrate this information, because I'll tell you a little bit of just my opinion right now, and I'll put this out here now and kind of maybe reiterate this throughout the day. I think that the changes in the DSM-5, reflected in the DSM-5 compared to the DSM-4, were, for the most part, there were a couple little things here and there that maybe I didn't like. Of course, nobody asked, me, but there were a couple things maybe here and there that I didn't completely understand or agree with. Why did they do this? Why did they do that? But I would say for me, 90%+ of the changes they made were very important and helpful changes. And then it just comes down to, whether today's practitioner, knowing how busy people are, knowing how, so many of us in our practices are kind of overwhelmed with just, doing the day-to-day life of helping people. When do we really have time to go back and learn these new processes? And so that can make it difficult. But I'll just tell you that I think, and again, in my own humble opinion, that I think the time you spend learning about these changes, especially some of the more dramatic ones reflected in this little outline right here, I think they would be very helpful to people in their practices, and I think you'll find yourself working not only more effectively, but also more efficiently. So you'll buy some of that time back that you spend deepening your understanding of these approaches. So here are the main areas, and I'll try not to just completely run through all these topics, and I'll be stopping every a few times throughout the presentation to see if there are more specific questions. How we do measurements, assessment measures, I think that's good. That was a big shift with the DSM-5. Reorganization of chapters, I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. The alternative model to personality disorders, I think probably if you were going to really invest time and effort, I think that, and if you're somebody who's going to be working, who does work or will be working with people with varying forms of personality disturbances, I think that is a very, very important area to dedicate some time and effort. Childhood and adolescent disorders, a lot of people who work primarily with children and families maybe were a little dismayed to find that that chapter went away, that those disorders kind of got scattered. They're still there, they're still in the DSM, but they kind of got moved all over in different locations in the DSM-5. Some interesting changes with neurocognitive disorders, especially the dementias and the way that we the way we look at those, the way we diagnose those. I think in particular, you'll see that these changes have and a lot, I'd say a lot of the changes as we kind of walk through this, you'll see that a clinical social worker is probably somebody who's going to find that there's more for us to do now with the diagnosing, whereas before in certain areas where they maybe were relying more heavily on psychological testing or medical testing, now they've brought it into more practical realms and domains that allow for us to be more involved there. And then finally, the psychotic and schizophrenia spectrum. It's actually the chapter is called Schizophrenia Spectrum and the Other Psychotic Disorders. And that chapter really reflects APA's preference now and sort of movement towards much more severity-oriented dimensional assessment, and you'll see that in numerous places in our conversation today. So moving along here, I think I maybe said a couple of these things. Let me point out a couple more items. Some of the basics and rationale for the change of the DSM-5. I think it must be said that APA has just over the last 20, 25 years is just coming closer and closer into sync with the ICD, and I think that just, again, in my humble opinion, I think that's been a really good thing because it's opening up. First of all, it sort of, you know, recognizes that we should be operating from the same research, we should be collaborating with each other, we should be, have shared understanding, and so I think that's something to be aware of and to feel pretty good about with the DSM-5 is that we are, we are going to be now much more compatible with our colleagues in Canada and Australia and in Europe and other places around the world. You may also notice that the DSM-5, we're now using the I don't know if you all can see my cursor, probably not, but the DSM-5, notice that we're using the Arabic numeral now, 5, and not the Roman numeral. And one of the ideas here is that the it's on my next slide, so I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So the DSM-5, a lot of new, different, recategorized areas. The dimensional assessment, again, is going to be very important. Some of you may be concerned that we are losing the multi-axial assessment. My sense is that a lot of agencies out there, practitioners, are going to prefer to keep the multi-axial assessment. And I just want to put that out there right now, too, that if there have been items in the previous DSMs that have been helpful to you or that you've integrated into your practice or into your agency's procedures, I think if we have to say the obvious here is that there is no DSM-5 police or APA police where they're saying you can no longer use these things. It's just that some of these items have changed in the DSM-5. five, they're not in there anymore. And so I think multi-axial assessment is one area that a lot of practitioners will probably continue to conceptualize their work with their clients this way, and will continue to use those categories to the clinical disorders, the physical, the socio-environmental, all those different axes that we had before. I'd say the one thing we have sort of gotten rid of, and I think this is a big improvement in the DSM-5, is that we no longer have the Global Assessment of Functioning Scale, the GAF score. And again, if agencies or practitioners want to keep using that, that's fine. But those have been replaced by the level 1 and 2 cross-cutting symptom severity rating scales. And then those two scales are very diagnostically oriented. And then the WHODAS is more global disability. That's the World Health Organization disability assessment schedule. And we'll get in a little bit more detail about that in a moment. Psychosocial as a dimensional component and not as a separate axis. So you're going to see the social environmental, and I think that's always important to social workers, being synthesized and really integrated a lot more with the criteria now, instead of separated out as a separate axis. Okay, I think APA would want to say loud and clear that they're not just in it for the money. And a lot of people have concerns about the DSM and how it's used, and there are certain dangers and things that can go along, especially if it's misused. But I think what they would want us to be aware of is that this is about research. This is about ongoing research and ongoing information, and if we're going to continue to learn more and more about these mental disorders, then we need to keep reflecting those in an ever-evolving book. And again, I alluded to this a moment ago. This is why they're getting rid of the Roman. They got rid of the Roman numerals. Going with, I think if you have an iPhone or an Android now, the operating systems, or like on your computer, the operating systems go on a 5, operating system 5, and then 5.1 and 5.2, and on we go. So I think that's what we're going to see from now on, is as there are revisions in the DSM, to the DSM, they'll come out as the next one will be 5.1, 5.2, and then it probably won't go into like the 6 until there are dramatic enough changes for them to move up a full number. And so they're definitely trying to set the tone that this is not the last one, and that this would be kind of an ever-evolving process, okay? All right. And I had a statement in here from the APA. Again, a lot of folks really call APA's motives into question. And I think if you go in and read the early chapters in the DSM, they are really usually the first to kind of point out, what their purpose is for. Scientific effort, developing a diagnostic criteria. They come right out and say, look, it does not fully describe the range of mental disorders that they can experience. I think APA themselves are saying we do not intend for this to be used as a single unilateral voice of authority, and it's the only way to think about our clients and the only way to conceptualize what's happening to them. But it is an attempt to get at a range of genetic environmental interactions over the course of human development affecting cognitive, emotional, and behavioral functioning. And they're saying that brings us so much complexity that to describe all of that, they're saying, and I think in some humility here, that they would never claim to be able to fully comprehensively encompass all the things that people experience at a mental, emotional, or behavioral level. So I just always feel like that's kind of an important thing to point out. I had hoped that I would be sharing a desktop with you all today and not just my slides. It's not a big deal, but what I would say to you is, if you are on a computer right now and you can multitask a little bit, what you could do is open up a web browser and do a Google search, or just type in DSM5.org with no spaces between DSM and the number 5, and then on the right hand side of the screen, scroll down and look for online assessment measures, or online, maybe it says online measures. And if you were not aware of this, I'm going to make your day right now. Are we good? I believe maybe somebody unmuted. Okay, are we good? Hopefully everybody can still hear me. So if you go to the DSM-5 website, you'll be able to download full versions of these instruments for free. And that is, I think, such a helpful resource. And so the level one and level two, these are just there to ask some. Level one are very general questions across, I think, 13 different domains of mental functioning. And it lasts things about depression, anxiety, anger, addictions, suicidal ideation, obsessive compulsive thinking and behaviors. And so with level one, you get sort of that broad, you get these broad domains. And then the way level one works is you, if red flags kind of show up on level one, they will point you to more specific level two instruments. And the level two instruments, like there would be a level two for depression or a level two for anxiety. And you could have a client or a patient who has both or more than that, and you would just use those instruments to go into more detail. And then those level two instruments essentially are just the outline for the diagnostic criteria. And that's the first glimpse we get at this dimensional assessment that APA is finding so important now. I think most of us who have been practicing, hopefully we weren't just thinking of our clients as either having a mental illness or not having a mental illness. Hopefully we were thinking in terms of, you know, severity ratings. I know before we had the mild, moderate, severe, and those kinds of specifiers, but we didn't really have much, at least from the APA, on ways to rank or rate the level of severity within these disorders. And so what you're going to see with these measures is that they are they give us a nice little Likert type item on which to rate the different areas of potential disturbance. So level one and level two are now are to be used to help us gain our first glimpse into potential diagnostic criteria that might be appropriate. And then the World Health Organization Disability Assessment schedule, I call it the HUDAS. I'm not sure how they refer to it around the world, but this instrument does nothing for diagnosing, but it is focused on level, on measuring the level of potential disability that's caused by really any disorder. And it should be very clear that the HUDAS is used across health conditions around the world. It's not used just for mental disorders, so it could be anybody with any kind of medical or physical or mental or emotional kinds of problems. And it really looks at these different domains like understanding and communicating, getting around, self-care, getting along with other people, life activities and participation in society. And so I really find that, you know, using the level one and level two along with something like the HUDAS, and then going in a little deeper, if you go to the DSM-5 website, you're going to see there are instruments across many, many different areas for personality disorders, psychosis, symptom severity, cognitive domains, and so there are many really in-depth instruments for us to use that they recommend, and so I find those very helpful, and I think this is a big improvement on what we had before with the GAF score, where we essentially, you know, ranked a person's overall functioning level across multiple domains on a 0 to 100 scale. I will point out with the HUDAS, it's on a 100-point scale also, but it's the opposite. With the GAF, a 100 was superior functioning. With the HUDAS, 100 would really indicate a 100% disability, and so we'll have to kind of, if you haven't done this already, you have to kind of switch your your perspective on that number. It means something, really means the opposite now of what we've used before. Okay, so that's a little bit about the assessment measures. And again, I wish I could bring some of these instruments onto the screen here and show you, but if you could just look those up and download those straight from the website and get a look at those, I would be happy to entertain any other questions you might have about them. All right, let me kind of put hold on the cultural formulation issue for just a moment here. I'm going to kind of move past this because that's going to come up in another slide down the road. Let's talk a little bit about the organization of the DSM-5 now. The Section 1 has the basics. It's got the intro, the use of the manual, the cautionary statement for forensic use. That really hasn't changed. Section 2, that's really where you're going to see a lot of the big shifts in organization within the DSM-5, so I want to point that out on the next slide. And then in Section 3, this is where they've always put the emerging models, measures and models, and that is still true, but this is also where you're going to find all these assessment instruments that are also available online. But one in particular, very important section within Section 3, and we'll talk about it quite a bit today, is the alternative DSM-5 model for personality disorders. That is a dramatic change. That is a new formulation for diagnosing personality disorders, and that lives in Section 3, so that's a very important thing to be aware of. But let's take a look at Section 2 of the DSM-5 and notice some of the big changes here. The items that are in blue and red, I'll talk about those quickly. You may remember in the DSM-4 that bipolar disorders and the depressive disorders were all in one chapter together called mood disorders, and APA has separated those out from each other now, and they're not using the language mood disorders, even though I still tended to refer to both of those as types of mood disorders. The anxiety disorders chapter that used to contain everything from generalized anxiety to the phobias to panic disorder, and then it also had obsessive compulsive and post-traumatic stress disorder. Now those have been separated out. So anxiety disorders retains the generalized anxiety, panic, phobias, social phobia, but now there's a separate chapter for the obsessive compulsive and related disorders, and then another chapter for trauma and stressor related. And I mentioned this earlier, let me say this again quickly now. Notice that there is no longer a chapter specifically for child. There was in the DSM-4, you had a chapter called disorders. This was a terrible name for a chapter anyway, but it was disorders usually first diagnosed in infancy, childhood, and adolescence. That chapter is gone. Those disorders are all still in the DSM-5, but they've been sort of spread out to their more appropriate chapters. So most of them are actually in the neurodevelopmental disorders in Chapter 1 of the DSM-5, like ADHD is there, intellectual disability, which we used to refer to as mental retardation, is there. But disorders like reactive attachment disorder, that's now considered a trauma and stressor-related disorder, so it's in the chapter with PTSD and acute stress disorder. We'll kind of I'll mention that again in a bit. So you can see here that there are some pretty significant changes in just the overall organization and just where you find disorders in the DSM-5. I should have mentioned this earlier. I'll say this now. If you are somebody who is really nervous about the DSM-5 coming out because you are very well trained on the DSM-4 and you feel like you've been out of step with the DSM-5, I would offer this encouragement to you. I really think that if you had a solid understanding of the diagnostic criteria for various mental disorders in the DSM-4, that you will find yourself, really your understanding of those disorders, I think, is 93% still accurate and the same as what we have now. So it's really kind of rare in the DSM-5 that you're going to find criteria that has really been altered that dramatically. There are some important reconceptualizations, and I'll mention a few of those today, but that's good news for those of you who really feel like you're still operating more out of the DSM-4 than the DSM-5. The areas where you will really want to come up to speed, I think, are just that if you're looking for things in the DSM-5, they won't be where you thought they were before necessarily. And then a lot of the language has changed to try to make the DSM-5 more culturally competent, more sensitive to areas where there might be stigma or stereotyping and those kinds of things. And so, and then with the actual assessment process and then just the overarching conceptualization of mental disorders now on increasingly looking at disorders on spectrum and then in terms of dimensions and in terms of a more deliberate look at severity ranges, not just of a disorder, but with each symptom or with each criteria within that disorder. Okay, it's that kind of attention to detail that APA seems to really be encouraging with us now. So let me get into the personality disorders. Rick, I don't know, maybe this would be a decent time to go ahead and pause before I get into some specific areas of mental disorders. Are there any questions right now I should address?
Mm-hmm. Great. I think that's a great idea, David. Now, since we have you all muted, if you want to, folks who are calling in, if you want to ask a question, you just have to hit *6 on your telephone keypad, or you can enter your question in the chat feature in the lower left-hand portion of the screen. So either hit *6 on your telephone keypad, or again, enter a question or a comment in the chat feature in the lower left-hand portion of the screen. So we'll take just a minute for anyone who wants to bring anything up.
Hello, I have a question.
Please go ahead.
Hi, so thank you so much for pointing out the website and the online assessment measures. You had said that there are many, sort of something like there are many others. I think you still meant on that same page within each category. Was that right, or was there another place where there were other assessment measures?
Yes, and one thing they did is initially all of the online assessment measures were laid out down the page, and now what they have dropped down. I think they've now with some drop down. So you'll see some plus signs, and wherever there's a plus sign, there's going to be a number of other.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Good. And while I'm waiting for another question, if there is another one, I would say if you would want to go on to that DSM-5.org site and look for the personality inventories, and I would open up the brief form as well as the broader personality inventory. You could just bring up the one for adults. Just as a reference point, that might be helpful. Rick, are there other?
David, there was a question that just came in on the chat screen. Kent wanted to know if there's a diagnostic tree that goes with DSM-5.
If there's a diagnostic tree, I'm not aware of any illustrated sort of flow charts, but I think most of the instruments really work that way now. And that is probably nowhere more true than with the personality inventory and this new process that they're looking at with personality disorders. So I think that Kent might be very interested in that.
Thanks.
But level one and level two. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just saying, Kent, if you have any follow-up question, just enter that in your chat screen. Go ahead, David.
Okay. Good. Is that it for now?
Looks like one other question on the chat, lower left-hand corner, David.
Okay. Sarah Ballou. Hello, Sarah. The DSM-5 website is DSM5.org. And if you go to that website and then from the main page, if you will scroll down and look on the right side of the screen, maybe I should do this, it's maybe the right side, you'll see a long, long list of topics, and within there you will see online assessment measures. And then if you just click on that, then you can go in and you'll see, I think, 6 different areas with plus signs next to them. Those all have drop-down menus for multiple free downloadable instruments there. Okay.
David?
All right.
I want to take
yes, sir.
I can switch the screen so that people can see your desktop. Did you want to take the time to show folks any of the websites that you referred to?
Okay.
You have the big red stuff.
Yeah. I'll delete that column completely, and then we'll just send it.
Okay. I'm going to move on to the personality disorders now, I could get hung up on this particular topic for several hours, so I will try to kind of work with some efficiency here. When the DSM-5 was coming out, it was clear on the website and from all the literature that we were to expect a brand new way of diagnosing personality disorders and that they would be getting rid of the old way. And APA did something very confusing to me, which was they left the old way of diagnosing personality disorders in Section 2, which is the main section of the DSM-5, and then they added this new alternative DSM-5 model for personality disorders. It's confusing because most of the models that are in Section 3 really are considered emerging or just they're kind of in the test phase, so they're not really recommending that we use them yet. In this case, APA was saying, okay, we think the alternative model is a better model. We think it's a much better way to do diagnosing for personality disorders. But because I think they were getting so much pushback about these changes, and they said we want to keep continuity with the current clinical practice, they left the old style in Section 2. And I mean, the thing is, the criteria themselves and the way we understand, like, borderline personality disorder is still borderline personality disorder, but it's just reformulated, it's reorganized in the DSM-5, and so we should not have a big issue with people having a different understanding of what narcissistic is or what schizotypal is or what obsessive compulsive personality disorder is. It's just a matter of how we are coming to these conclusions. That's something that's going to be very different if a lot of people are still using the older model in Section 2 versus people maybe getting trained in the last few years or moving on, preferring the alternative model. I will also tell you, and I have research on this, it's pretty new, and I would be happy to share this, that most of the people, they're showing, this was my opinion for a few years, and now I'm seeing actual research to back this up, that most people who take time to study the alternative model really do think it's a superior way to kind of wrap your mind around personality disorders, okay? And in particular, one of the more helpful changes with the alternative approach is that you don't have to feel the need to put a person who you're convinced has a personality disturbance of some sort into a particular category. With this new approach, you focus on varying domains of disturbance, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, and then you figure out where are these disturbances, and you're not thinking, is it borderline, is it narcissistic, is it avoidant, is it dependent? You're just going domain by domain, trait by trait, and kind of see where that leads you. And that's what the assessment measure is really good for. The assessment measure is very helpful for walking us through that process of really inventorying the types of personality disturbance we might be seeing. And so that, to me, is a much more objective way. It's a much more systematic way to get at, you know, what might or might not be a personality disorder. Okay. So the one more interesting point to mention here, in the DSM-IV, APA had some unfortunate language, and they really emphasized people who were, and this was their language, deviating from cultural norms. And in the DSM-IV, that was the first thing that the general criteria mentioned was, you know, basic, and you know, obviously that kind of language could be taken to mean that there is a cultural norm, and that if you're not in the cultural norm, then therefore you are disordered in some way. And APA really wanted to walk that back quite a bit. And so notice here now that they're really focusing on just impairment. They're focusing on the personality traits, the domains, the disturbance itself, and the inflexible and pervasive nature of a personality disorder. And then the very last thing they say is, it's not normal, this is paraphrasing, but it's pretty close, not normal developmentally or socioculturally. And so they're not saying anymore that there is one cultural norm and these people are deviating from it. What they're really talking about now is that in addition to having this impairment and disturbance, which is the most important thing, right, because we're allowed to have eccentric personalities, and you can be any way you want to be if you're happy and functional and you can work and you can take care of yourself and you can do all these things. So it's really just they're focusing on the impairment level here. And then they're saying, in addition to that, probably this person is a bit out of step with the norms of development and of sociocultural context. Okay, so it's a consideration now and not an emphasis, and I just think that's really important to mention. All right, so another reason that this is confusing for a lot of people, in the DSM-5 alternative model, they're basically proposing getting rid of four of these disorders, and for those of you following along with my notes, I will admit to you and confess to you that I left one of the disorders they were removing off of the slide, and so paranoid, the ones they were removing in the alternative model are paranoid, schizoid, histrionic, and dependent. Now you may be thinking, well, we don't have those anymore. Well, here's why it's confusing. We still have them because we still have the old model in section two. And so when you're using the alternative model, there are not constructs for diagnosing paranoid, schizoid, histrionic, or dependent. But there are, but those diagnostic criteria still remain in section two. But as far as the alternative model is concerned, borderline is still there, and then OCPD, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, and let me see here. Yeah, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, avoidant, schizotypal, antisocial, and narcissistic. I have schizotypal and antisocial in blue here because I wanted to quickly point out that the APA is doing something relatively different and new for them as well, which is they're cross-listing some disorders now. So I will point out that schizotypal is still considered a personality disorder, but it is also now the mild end of the schizophrenia spectrum. And so if you go to the chapter on schizophrenia spectrum, there'll be a little placeholder page in there for schizotypal, referring you back to the personality disorder chapter for the criteria. But it's also considered to be on the spectrum for the schizophrenia spectrum. And then antisocial is also cross-listed, not as a psychotic disorder. It's cross-listed with disruptive impulse control and conduct disorders. So antisocial remains as a personality disorder, but then is also now considered over there with kleptomania and intermittent explosive disorder with impulse control problems. Okay, but the one thing that we can do now with the alternative model that we did not have before, and I should have mentioned this more clearly on this slide, is the PDTS. PDTS, and that is, it is on here, I'm sorry, includes the personality disorder trait specified. And when you use the instrument, the personality inventory instrument, you can now go in, and if you feel like there are enough areas of disturbance, but those areas don't fall nicely and neatly enough into a specific disorder like borderline or like narcissistic, then you can say there is a personality disorder here. It just doesn't just fit within one or even two necessarily personality disorders, but there is one, and it's justifiable given the following traits and domains. So I've used that language now, I think, for a few minutes on traits and domains. Maybe you're wondering a little bit about what those are. So here to me is one of the biggest improvements with the alternative model for personality disorders. Before, you may remember that, and I can show an example of this, I think. Let me see if I've got that on this slide. Let me advance a moment. You may remember before that in the DSM-4, when they would list a personality disorder like schizotypal, for instance, it would look something like this. You would have a general definition of that disorder, and then it would just list out, you know, a kind of, I always kind of refer to it as a laundry list of other disturbances, and then it would go on to say it's clinically significantly, disabling or impairing. But otherwise, you would just kind of get this, not random, but just kind of a collection of ideas about what was going on with this person. Remember and kind of note that if you use criteria like this, you're kind of just saying yes or no. It's kind of more like a checklist. You're not really saying, okay, to what extent do they have ideas of reference, or to what extent do they have odd beliefs or magical thinking, to what extent do they have all these different things. It's just more of a yes or no, and you kind of go down through the criteria. And now what we have is basically a way of organizing every single disorder in the same outline like you see here, criterion A and criterion B. And this is what schizotypal looks like now in the DSM-5. And let me back up again to the general criteria. If you were going to spend some serious brain power memorizing something from the DSM-5, I think this would be a great place to focus for a little while. Criterion A and B, I think this is a very helpful construct for understanding not only how to diagnose a personality disorder, but also just to kind of understand what personality is. What do we really mean by that? What is APA really getting at here with personality, and how are we looking at that? And they basically, in criterion A, tell us that, it's split up into self, intrapersonal, so personality is how we experience ourselves within ourselves, and then interpersonal, which is how we relate to other human beings. And in the intrapersonal, it's our sense of identity and our sense of self-direction, which has, in my mind, to do with what drives us, what are our motivations. With interpersonal, it has to do with empathy, the extent to which we do or do not have that, and then the ability to be engaged in relationship. They call that intimacy. They're referring really just to ability to relate to other people in a personal manner. But criterion B, now this is what's pretty daring for APA in my view. They are now basically claiming to have an exhaustive list of potential personality disturbances, areas of disturbance. And they have said that we think that personality disturbances occur in five broad domains. So those are the trait domains, okay? And then within those five domains, you're going to see 25. So if you had five trait domains, right, across the board, you're going to see 25 facets kind of spread throughout those five domains. And so they're basically saying that if you want to define personality in general and then personality disturbance in particular, that can be done within these very kind of, this pretty limited group of potential issues, right? What I like about that personally is that it doesn't give this feeling to the diagnostic criteria like they can just kind of go in any direction they want, or they can use broad conceptualizations, assuming that we all are kind of using the same language. What I like is the sense that, there is if we know that there's kind of a somewhat exhaustive list, and again, that might be something they revise over the years to come. They may say, well, we should maybe add a domain, or maybe we should add a few facets here and there, but to at least have an attempt at some concise a contained number of potential areas of disturbance, I think that is a very helpful thing. And so I think spending a little time looking at these domains and the facets could be helpful. So here they are. Here are the five domains. You have negative affectivity, detachment, antagonism, disinhibition, and psychoticism. Okay, I would quickly point out when they say psychoticism, they're not saying psychotic. They're saying somebody with psychotic-like tendencies, and so they're not quite. If they're psychotic, obviously that would fall under schizophrenia spectrum or psychotic disorders. There. The other helpful thing I think they do here is with each domain, not only do they list the facets that are underneath them, like negative affectivity includes emotional lability, anxiousness, separation insecurity, submissiveness, hostility, on and on we go. The other helpful thing here is that they give us the healthy counterpart to this disturbance. So if negative affectivity is the domain for disturbance, then emotional stability is what's missing here. Therefore, that's what we kind of want to work toward with our clients. And so in a way, they're giving us language, I think, now to help us with our treatment planning and something to kind of focus on with our clients. So you have negative affectivity, detachment versus extroversion. One of my students says, why not just call that sociable? Why use a word like extroversion? But that's, I think that's a useful way of thinking about that. Antagonism versus agreeableness, disinhibition versus conscientiousness, and psychoticism versus lucidity. Now, it must be said that not every single disorder is going to have all of the domains or all of the facets. Like you see here with schizotypal, if you look down in letter B here, you're going to see that that under the domains and facets, you have three of the five domains represented. And then the APA gives you the facets that are showing up within each domain. So now, if you were to memorize criteria, you would, you know, probably want to mostly focus on memorizing the criterion A, which is how does a person with a disorder like this experience this within themselves and in relationship? And then in criterion B, what are the general areas of disturbance? And I've been trying to find the best ways to encourage my students to, I say encourage, I mean force them to memorize their criteria. I don't really think it's fair for me to try to have them memorize all of the facets to go along with every single diagnosis. So I've been trying to find a way to, you know, what would be a good way to kind of get your mind wrapped around each disorder related to the alternative model here without, you know, really overwhelming yourself. And I think it would just be have a decent understanding of each domain and the facets that are within that, but then for your own purposes, focus more on the domains, the five domains rather than the 25 facets. And then if you're using the inventory, and by the way, there's a brief inventory and then a more elaborate inventory. Personally, what I would say is that if you were working with somebody and you had a hint it seemed like they might have some personality disturbance, I think that would be a good time to use the brief form. If you're working with somebody and it feels very, very clear to you that they have probably a deep personality disturbance of some kind, that's when you use the long form. The difference is pretty significant. I think the brief form is somewhere around 25 questions, and then the long version is 225 questions. And when you get the results, what they do is they give you severity ratings along the domains. Now that would be for the brief form. It's gonna measure each disturbances under each domain. Okay, so when you go to look at the criteria, you have numbers for antagonism, numbers for negative affectivity, and so you're not just working on your impressions here. You're going with actual data now. And then with the full version of the personality inventory, you're going to get rankings and ratings throughout all 25 facets in addition to the domains. And so that's a much more detailed, intense sort of analysis of the personality disorders themselves. So let me pause here. Questions about this was probably one of the bigger topics for today. The other ones I can maybe kind of go through some of the deep, smaller details, or more important, I should say, more important details, but it won't take as much time. But perhaps there are some questions about personality disorders.
Great. Thanks, David. Again, if you're interested in posing a question or making a comment, just hit *6 on your telephone keypad, or you can type a message into the chat feature on the lower left-hand portion of the screen. David, do you see a couple of quick items in the chat screen?
Let's see here. So there should not be a lot of big differences between the two presentations. I think I just did some updates this morning. I will be very happy to share the full PowerPoint with you all. I'm not seeing any other questions, Rick.
Nope, done. Someone liked that you used the term forced to memorize. They like your assertive style.
Yeah, I surely do, and I think it's very important. This information is not—it's not so intuitive that I think we can just go out and apply it loosely. So, I hopefully my students would not say that I make them miserable, but I definitely they work pretty hard. I had a great professor who worked me very hard in this area too, and I really appreciated that because, you know, in some areas it's kind of like a foreign language. It's you have to really take some time to internalize it. So thank you. Okay, can we move on then? Or
yeah. So any last questions?
I need to lock everybody. I'm doing so well that
if anyone did have a last question, *6 on your telephone keypad, or a message down in the chat screen. We'll give you another 3 seconds, and then we'll be moving on. Okay, David, back to you.
Okay. All right. According to my calculations, we have about maybe 18 minutes or so. So let me kind of just hit some of the highlights here. I mentioned that the chapter on disorders usually first diagnosed in infancy, childhood, and adolescence got, you know, sort of, you know, taken apart there. You'll find the biggest collection of those disorders in the neurodevelopmental disorders chapter now. I think some key points to keep in mind, intellectual development disorders, that language is both consistent with ICD, so now we'll be using language more consistent with what our colleagues internationally are using. And then obviously the term retardation has become such, has been used so inappropriately in our culture that APA, like so many terms over the years, really wanted to separate themselves from that language. So intellectual disability is one way that you'll see it in the DSM-5, but intellectual development disorders, I think that's the way the our colleagues abroad are referring to it. Autism spectrum disorder, and I think I have a slide on this. One more thing about the intellectual development disorders. This is a very important change for social workers, I think. In the DSM-4, they put a very heavy premium on IQ testing, and so presumably a psychologist or somebody doing IQ testing would have been more involved with the diagnosing. Now what you'll see is we have instruments that look at conceptual, social, and practical criteria. Those are all things that a clinical social worker should be able to rate. And they still are interested in IQ testing, but they found that not to be a very reliable way to evaluate a person's abilities. And this is about looking for ability and disability. And so we want to be aware of both of those things. And so, so yes, the criteria was, I think, very helpfully reorganized here. And the clinical social worker can be and should be much more involved in evaluating across these areas. So so I think that's a very good change. You all may be aware that the pervasive developmental disorders that included autism, Asperger's, Rett's disorder. That's different now. We don't really use the pervasive developmental disorder language anymore. And autism and Asperger's have been folded together into an autism spectrum. And I expected to see much more pushback on that change. I thought that the Asperger's community, for instance, would be very interested in keeping that criteria or keeping that name, because I think so many people were identified with it. And but I for one never really did see or hear a lot of pushback on that. And so all of these are collapsed now into the autism spectrum. They really look at two dimensions. You have social communication problems and then restricted interests and repetitive behaviors. And then they're looking at three levels of severity. And so let me just show you, these are the, I think I have a couple of examples of this, but level one severity for autism spectrum, that would presumably be the what used to be Asperger's. So people formerly diagnosed with Asperger's disorder presumably now would be getting a level one autism spectrum disorder, maybe level two, but that's moving on to more marked deficits. And then level three would be your more severe autism, and where you see somebody with extreme difficulty coping or an more extreme level of severity and impairment. Let me see if the there's a question that says it can wait till later. Okay, I will try to get back to that. So that's autism spectrum. I think with ADHD, there's not a lot that has changed here, except that I think it's very important to notice that in the DSM-4, ADHD, it wasn't intended to be on a spectrum, but if you read the DSM-4 in that chapter, it went ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, and then conduct disorder. I think for many, it felt like that was a continuum or a spectrum of behavioral problems. And APA is making a very bold statement here. When they put ADHD in the neurodevelopmental disorders, they're saying ADHD has a strong biological, not behavioral, etiology. And then what you'll see is that oppositional defiant and conduct disorders have now been moved over into the disruptive impulse control and conduct disorder chapter. And so those disorders have kind of been reorganized, recategorized. There are some interesting changes with oppositional defiant and conduct disorder. In particular, with conduct disorder, APA is much more specific now by what they mean with a conduct disorder. Remember, conduct disorder is the, you know, when you have a diagnosis of antisocial in adulthood, there has to be evidence of a conduct disorder in childhood. And so antisocial is the one personality disorder that we don't ever diagnosed before the age of 18. And so conduct disorder is sort of that precursor, we worry that it is, to the antisocial personality disorder. So there's a lot more detail in that criteria for conduct disorder that I think people will find helpful. Also in the DSM-4, they implied that you should try to figure out if it's ODD or conduct disorder, and we shouldn't have those together. That exclusion criteria has been removed, and so presumably now you could have somebody with a conduct disorder who also presents with a very negative and hostile demeanor like you would expect to see with oppositional defiant disorder. So on conduct disorder, everything in orange here, those are changes. Those are actually not just changes, they're new to the criteria, so you can imagine how limited this criteria was before. Reactive attachment disorder, this is a big deal. I think a lot of people work with children and families with attachment issues. They know reactive attachment disorder. In the DSM-4, reactive attachment disorder had two types. There was an inhibited type and a disinhibited type. Keep in mind now that we have two separate disorders reflecting inhibited and disinhibited. So according to the DSM-5, now with reactive attachment disorder, that is only the inhibited type. And the same criteria that we used before with reactive attachment disorder now also applies to disinhibited social engagement disorder, but in disinhibited social engagement disorder, which is a mouthful, the here we have the child who is indiscriminately connecting and attaching to adults and other people in a way that's inappropriate. So this is one picky thing that I, for one, did not like about the changes in the DSM-5. I thought that the construct they had before, where you had two types of reactive attachment disorder, was just fine. That way, I did not think that was confusing. I think this is more confusing, but that's just, it's just a language preference and nothing that I don't feel like I can live with here. But for those of you working with children and families, I think this will be a very important detail to keep in mind, is that we don't really have the two different types of reactive attachment disorder anymore. And then disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. This is a disorder for children. Many of you may be aware that there was a problem a number of years back. I think it started about 15 or 16 years ago, where more and more children were diagnosed with bipolar disorder. APA has created this disruptive mood dysregulation disorder and placed it in the depressive disorders chapter, I think in hopes that what practitioners like clinical social workers were seeing as bipolar disorder, they will now view this sort of acting out, this intense energy outburst thing that many were thinking of as bipolar disorder in children, that we would think of it now more as a depressive disorder. And so for those of you who are working with children who have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, or who you've suspected of having some kind of mood fluctuation problem, you might look into this criteria and see if you think that's a little more fitting for that person. Okay. Neurocognitive disorders. So in the DSM-4, we call these cognitive disorders, not neurocognitive. This is an area where you have Alzheimer's type dementia, for instance. Very interesting here. In the DSM-4, the APA basically implied that the mental health professional should be able to ascertain the type of dementia a person is experiencing. And of course, that's something for brain scans, brain imaging, and even postmortem analysis, not for somebody interviewing a client in an office to determine. And so the changes to the neurocognitive disorders, I think, are very, very good. I think they are realistic. And once again, I think clinical social workers have now a bigger role to play in the assessment process, which is you're looking at these areas of assessment like complex attention, executive ability, learning, and memory. And by the way, there is a wonderful construct for this, or table or framework, in section 3 of the DSM-5. To my understanding, I don't have a digital version of this one. I don't know why. It's one of the few they don't have also on the website. I typed up my own just because I thought it was so helpful. And so I would be very happy to share that with Rick to give to you all as well. So you can just have a digital copy of it, but it's in the DSM-5. But these are areas that we can evaluate and look into with our clients, I think, much more so than what we did before. And then what you're going to see is we no longer worry ourselves with figuring out what kind of dementia it is, whether it's Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or something else. We only focus on if it's major or mild. And probably they could add some more severity ranges there, but we're just looking to determine across these areas of assessment if the person appears to be in a state of major impairment with their cognitive disorder, or in a more mild area, and then presumably they would go on for a lot more elaborate and extensive medical testing to determine the nature of the dementia or the cognitive disorder, and more medical and physical treatment that would go along with that. But from that perspective, an Alzheimer's type dementia could be minor or major, or could be mild or major, either one. It just depends on the level of severity there. Okay, so it's another example of using this dimensional assessment in a way that I think is quite helpful. All right, we're going to be running out of time. Let me see if I can get to a couple more details, especially related to the quiz that you'll have. And I think really if I just mention this about schizophrenia spectrum, that might cover the material that is a fair game for the quiz that you'll have, which, by the way, does not require memorization. So, but schizophrenia spectrum. So this was this will be my last point, and then I'll stop talking. But with in the DSM-5, the schizophrenia spectrum now. The big change here is, well, compared to the DSM-4, in the DSM-4, basically that chapter started with schizophrenia, which is one of the most severe forms of psychotic disorders that are out there. And then the rest of the disorders were just kind of laid out in no particular order. Now what they're doing is they're laying it in a spectrum of most mild, the most mild of psychotic disorders to the most severe. And so it starts with schizotypal personality disorder, and then it goes all the way across to the other side of the spectrum to schizoaffective disorder. And once again, we see a nice new dimensional assessment instrument here, the clinician-rated dimensions of psychosis symptom severity scale. And it is a very simple, really, construct framework. It's pretty quick and fast and pretty easy, user-friendly instrument, and you can just go in and rate obviously whether the person is having a particular symptom like hallucinations, delusions, disorganized behavior, the negative symptoms, but not only if, but also to what extent, how severe are these symptoms in each of these areas. And so in this case, the idea of dimensional assessment has to do with both the fact that there's a spectrum on which these psychotic disorders exist, and that within each disorder, we're looking at the severity of each symptom and not just if the system exists. And I said I would hush after that. Let me mention one last thing. I think there's been some very interesting and promising science in the area of prodromal schizophrenia, which is trying to figure out preventatively who and screen for people who it looks like might develop schizophrenia or some sort of psychotic disorder. They're calling that an attenuated psychosis syndrome. I highly recommend that you read up on this research. And basically what it would suggest is the earlier we can get these folks on a newer atypical second generation, or what maybe some people are calling third generation antipsychotic. Obviously that's not for us to say, but the science basically is suggesting the sooner these folks can start medication, the better, because that's really moderating the dopamine absorption in the brain that we think is causing the damage that leads to a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia. So, okay, I think I better bring this in for a landing. I am very happy to stick around for as long as there are questions, but maybe everybody else has somewhere they need to be. So, Rick, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Just to let you know, there's one question in the queue. Maybe Kent, if you can stay for a couple of minutes after we wrap up our session, David can answer the question that you had posed in the chat room session. But for now, again, I want to thank everyone for participating in the session. David, most of all, for today's excellent discussion. Lots and lots to learn, lots that I didn't know that I didn't know, but really appreciated the time to learn from or to hear from all you've been learning. For those of you interested in obtaining documentation of CEUs, simply go to the page on the NECSW website where you originally registered for this training and simply click on follow-up CEU link. I will also in the next 5 minutes be sending you an email, and you can press on this link to be able to go to the page where, again, you'll be able to apply for the CEUs for this session. Once you're there on this page, simply type in your email address, click and enter, and you'll take a simple 10 or 12 question online quiz, fill out the evaluation, and you'll be able to print out your CEU documentation online without having to wait for any response from the office. I'd also like to take just a minute to invite you to consider signing up for NECSW's next audio conference scheduled for Monday, November 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The topic in November will be Seeking the Shalom of the City, Applied Urban Ministry Context, facilitated by Dr. Kevin Brown. So kind of the flip side of social work from the important clinical work that we heard about today. Next session will be looking at macro social work, working with communities in urban ministry contexts.
So thanks again for participating. Please don't hesitate to contact us if you have any questions or comments. And once again, David, our appreciation for sharing from all you've been learning with all of us. Hope everyone has a terrific day. And
pleasure.
Go ahead.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dave. So everyone's free to sign off, but if some of you want to hang out with Kent and David while David answers Kent's question, feel free to do that. But otherwise, we'll officially adjourn. Again, thanks all for joining us.
Okay. Kent asks, since the DSM-5 came along, psychiatrists who I work with are using less detailed diagnoses such as psychiatric disorders or mood disorders or anxiety disorders, for example, moving towards the general as opposed to becoming more detailed. Is that because of DSM-5 or perhaps in a working correctional environment that has a legal component? Kent, that is a great question. I have to say, and this is something that if I had 6 hours, surely I would have mentioned. Sorry, let me turn off my little timer here. I would certainly have mentioned this before now or during a longer conversation. There should be more detail. There should be more specificity and more clarity. My concern, and this is what the research is kind of telling us, and this is one of the reasons I really appreciate doing these kinds of trainings and kind of raising the awareness. I know when I was practicing, I had a very before I was teaching and out there working a full time job practice, it was really hard to find time to get stay current on the literature and on the changes. And if they completely changed around this one framework that I'd been using for years and years, that would have been extremely difficult for me. So I get that, and I get that struggle. So my sense is that a lot of people have just really, even 3 years later, still haven't come up to speed with a lot of these changes. And one thing that you'll see is, especially with substance-related disorders, really across all the chapters, they've gotten rid of the NOS, or the not otherwise specified. Now, there is no way to be vague. You can still get away with that, but it's less there are fewer constructs built into the system for being vague now. Like with substance-related also, there was you could do the polysubstance abuse. And, that could have meant marijuana and alcohol, or that could have meant methamphetamine and opiates. And, anybody who's working in that field knows that those would be two radically different types of issues. And so we need to be more specific. And I surely don't think you would ever hear APA saying this. And I really don't think it's implied in the DSM-5 that we should be more general and vague. I don't mean to throw your colleagues under the bus here, but I kind of feel like maybe that is more of sort of the environment there and the way that it's being used. One last thing I would say about that, perhaps people are aware that there are these changes and just kind of feel like, why bother, and maybe just kind of go with a more general or vague response or diagnosis or explanation for what they're seeing with their clients. So I hope that's helpful.
David, can you see Robert Luck's question down at the bottom of the chat room screen?
Yeah, I think Diane asked if I'd recommend buying a print version of the DSM-5. Absolutely, get yourself a copy of the DSM-5, and they're pretty inexpensive now. I bought mine the day that it came out at the bookstore, and it was like $125. And I think now you can get them on Amazon for $25 or $30. So I think you absolutely want that, and you might as well get the full version, honestly, because it's going to have a little more discussion and description in there of what's really happening. Did you say Robert?
Rick? Robert Luck's question, asking about the religious/spiritual
problem diagnosis?
Yeah, and I did not mention that. I think that, like I wrote in my description for the presentation, I really think it's important for Christians in social work to really stay up on these areas. What you're going to see with APA in general, and I think they would put kind of religious and spiritual in with cultural competence and respect, is that we are absolutely, and I kind of feel like most of the rationale that the APA puts out there helps social workers, and I think Christians in social work. I think it helps us find a little bit more common ground to kind of come together and to use these things. I don't think you're going to find really overt statements within the DSM-5, in terms of specifically going out and evaluating, for instance, how much resiliency does this person have because of their faith. That would be something I feel like a lot of us would be, I know that's something I'm very interested in. But I think at minimum, they are strongly urging us to pay very close attention to cultural context, and I think for APA probably they would put religion and spiritual experience and perspectives, kind of they would weave that in with sort of cultural perspectives as well. And so I think they're definitely trying to encourage a very respectful, not just consider it, but like really consider how does this play into the overarching framework of what the person is experiencing, good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Either Kent or Robert, if you had a follow-up with regard to your question, feel free to ask that. Sounds like we're not going to let David go easily.
And I'm scrolling through the chat just to see if there's anything that it looks like I missed. Should have been a little more clear about the publication date. DSM-5 came out in 2013. DSM-4 TR was in 2000. But if you go back to the 4 to the DSM-5, this was the longest period of time between revisions that we've ever seen with the DSM. So it's kind of important to know that there was a lot of buildup to these changes.
David, if you would be able to send me a copy of the version of the PowerPoint you used today, it sounds like there'll be some people who will be interested in the small tweaking that you had done the version that you had with earlier. So if you give me the most up-to-date version, when people check in for that, I'll send that out to them.
Very happy to do that.
Anything else from folks hanging in afterwards before we wind down for good?
Hello, can you hear me? This is Diane, just following up on the book question.
Hi, Diane.
Hi there. So I have a book, DSM-4 Made Easy, from James Morrison, The Clinician's Guide to Diagnosis. It was helpful over the years, becoming a psychotherapist, to help differentiate some diagnoses. Is there anything out there yet that you would recommend?
Well, my approach has been just dive into the book itself and make as much sense of it. I wanted to be careful not to lean too much on other, no matter how helpful they are. And I've heard great things about that book, and I've looked into that book some myself. And I know I have colleagues who teach in this area, and they like using that. So I think those can be very good. But I, for one, kind of feel like the DSM-5 is thick enough, to keep me busy. And honestly, I think the language is really clear to me. And if you were to read something in the DSM-5 that felt confusing, then I think you could, go into the website. There are articles riddled throughout their website that really describe their thought process and the develop. process of how they came to a lot of their changes and everything. So I kind of feel like, you know, I would recommend to people really experience the DSM-5 for yourself, read through the materials yourself, use the website. When in doubt, Google it, see what other people are out there, you know, talking about on the internet, and you can kind of get a feel for those conversations that are happening. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm still learning so much from the actual DSM-5 that I just haven't, you know, found it necessary, or maybe I'm just not ready yet for a supplemental reading to go along with that.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that opinion.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members, and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.